B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, April 18th, 2017. It is the official deadline for you to submit your tax returns. And I submit that this is an exercise in futility. Basically, the IRS forces you to fill out these forms to prove that you didn't lie to them when you filled out the forms. Because they've already got almost all of the information that you put on your tax returns. And this suspicion occurred to me over the last month or so. Every evening I'd put aside a half hour, maybe an hour, to work on my taxes. I've been doing my own returns for years. Maybe 5 years out of 40, I hired a tax preparation expert. Other than that, I do it myself. And it gets more and more convoluted, despite the fact that everything is computerized. The IRS has the data from my Schwab account of whether I earned dividends or owe capital gains taxes from last year. They've got a record of any W-2 income that I have. In my case, what they don't have is the income or loss from my business, Schedule C. But last night, this was confirmed for me in a brief exchange between Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show, and his guest, Austin Goolsbee. Goolsbee is an economist, served in the Obama administration, and this appeared to be rehearsed, but it was squeezed in right before the end of the interview. And Noah said, "Hey, Austin, you got any ideas on how we could change the tax system?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Just what I told you, that the IRS has the information from other people about your finances in the past year. And they should use that information to send you a tax bill, a pre-filled out 1040 form, and you just go through and say, oh yeah, that W-2 income is right. Or maybe you make a correction and say, they missed $10 of dividends from XYZ Corporation. I'll report that. And you could do your own taxes without an H&R Block, without a CPA. You could probably do it in half an hour or less. And for many people who use a 1040A and some of the short forms, it would be like mailing back a postcard." And Austin Goolsbee was asked by Trevor Noah as the show was wrapping up, "So, hey, why hasn't this happened?" And the answer is that we have a $2 billion industry based on tax preparation. These are the people who sell the loopholes to the rich and who fill out the forms for the rest of us. And they have a powerful lobby in Washington that has prevented Congress from even experimenting with a reverse process. As I've described, the IRS sends you a bill instead of you submitting these forms and then quivering to say, gosh, did I report everything? They know everything about me, so if I fail to report, I could be in trouble, right? And I got to take one more whack at this form 8962. I've described it as punishment for Obamacare recipients. And I'm going to do a Facebook Live video about this later today. I just can't help it. Because it's so infuriating, the form requires you to look up the federal poverty level, and there are only three figures for that, one for Alaska, one for Hawaii, and one for the rest of the country. They could print it on this goddamn form, but they don't. They make you look it up. And then you got to do some calculations to find out if your adjusted gross income was within 400% of the poverty line. What if you screw up that calculation? Then you have to find the applicable figure, a murky factor number in four decimal points that means absolutely nothing to me. And then you have to successfully multiply your income times the applicable figure. Now, this is a very empty exercise, because all you have to do is tell the IRS, did my income change over the 12-month period last year? And if so, it went up or it went down, and they can easily calculate what your subsidy amount would be, and whether they owe you money or you owe them money. In my case, they owed me an extra $600. But it took me over 30 minutes to fill this out, and I cheated a little bit by using information from last year's form. It is ridiculous. And as we observe that the guy in the White House, number 45, continues to thumb his nose at us and refuses to release his tax returns. And of course, he said he would, but he's under audit, and that is such a bullshit excuse. I mean, it's worse than the dog ate my homework, or the dog ate my thumb drive with the homework on it. That's the updated version. And so it is interesting to see that a tactic that the Democrats have been using appears to be gaining some traction. And they're saying, look, we can't reform the tax code or change it to benefit Trump and his rich cronies without knowing what changes in the tax code would directly benefit Trump and his family enterprise. And for example, we know that Trump hates the alternative minimum tax. And we know from the single tax return we've seen that was sent to David K. Johnston that in 2005, he only paid taxes because of the calculations of the alt-min tax. And so, without knowing how that benefited Trump in other years, we can only guess that removing the alternative minimum tax would be a real benefit to Donald Trump. So these are not insignificant issues. It's not just people curious about how much money he made. It might disclose contacts with Russian individuals and entities that would be interesting to the current investigation. And now more than a dozen Republican lawmakers say that Trump should release his tax returns. And this is interesting because, as I mentioned, this does appear to be a useful tactic. Steven Mnuchin, who is the Treasury Secretary and the guy who managed all those foreclosures at IndyMac was the name of the bank, I think. Well, he told the Financial Times that Trump's goal of getting a tax plan signed by August was not realistic at this point. One of the other issues is they needed the repeal and destruction of Obamacare in order to create the phantom savings that could then be given to the rich in the form of corporate and personal tax cuts. So here we are on the day when many Americans have to fork over extra money to the government. And Trump is arrogantly, really insulting each and every one of us with his actions or failure to release his tax returns. Meanwhile, it was down to the final 10 minutes in Arkansas last night when the United States Supreme Court declined to allow the state to go forward with the scheduled executions. This is a major victory for the condemned inmates and their attorneys. And the court was petitioned earlier in the day. And finally, at 11:50 p.m., just before the death warrant for Don Davis was about to expire, the court announced it had declined to lift a stay on that execution, leaving it in place. Now, this brings to 3 the number of convicted and condemned prisoners who have been spared the ambitious execution schedule set by Asa Hutchinson, the Republican governor, former member of Congress, and a certified Neanderthal. So the next one is scheduled for Thursday night, and they still have, at least on their planning documents, plans to conduct executions this Thursday, next Monday, and the following Thursday. And it remains to be seen if court action will be able to delay and at least temporarily block those executions. As you know, the cocktail of lethal drugs that they need to execute these men is also expiring at the end of April. There don't appear to be any fresh sources of the execution drugs. And I find this Supreme Court ruling interesting because in the last few years, they've been taking the position, don't bother us with these appeals about how you execute these people. Just snuff them, for God's sake. You know, we've decided to kill them. Who cares how it happens? I mean, it's really that callous, the tone coming from the Supremes. So this is a bit of a change. And I'm not going to credit Judge Gorsuch, who just arrived on the bench, although he likely would have participated in the discussions on Monday night. Today, the Trumpster is traveling to Kenosha, Wisconsin. That's north of Milwaukee. He's going to the Snap-on Tools plant, probably to ogle the calendars with hot babes that Snap-on Tools is most famous for. But he is going to put his Don Trump Hancock on another one of these flashy executive orders. And we're told that it is aimed at making it harder for technology companies to recruit low-wage workers from foreign countries and undercut Americans looking for jobs. Now, I generally support this notion. I think Barack Obama could have done more to use the bully pulpit to shame American employers in ways that Trump has done with limited success. And, of course, he exaggerates the limited success to the hilt. But I do credit Trump for taking the initiative. But like so many cases, just like the wall that is being built to keep out people who aren't trying to get in, for the most part, well, it turns out that the tech industry has sharply reduced the number of applications for H-1B visas, and I don't know exactly why. Last year, there were 236 applications for 85,000 visas that were granted. And as of the current, I don't know when this cutoff point is, but the San Francisco Chronicle, on a front page story today, reports that the number of applications has fallen below 200,000. It's right at 199,000. So once again, Trump has a solution for a problem that appears to have, in many ways, corrected itself. Hey, don't let reality get in the way of your spun-up version of reality, Donald. And here's another example of that. As we know, Trump got into a bluffing contest with Kim Jong-un, the wacky and unpredictable leader of North Korea. And in full bluster, Trump announced that we had a flotilla. He called it an armada, a beautiful armada, and he blurted out that included a submarine that appears to be leaking information that should have been kept secret, if not classified. And he said that that armada was steaming for the Korean Peninsula. So Mike Pence goes, backed up by this U.S. flotilla, armada, whatever you want to call it. And Mike Pence goes to the 38th parallel, the demilitarized zone. And he looks tough and he squints over the border at North Korea. And the photo op is highly successful. Only the Washington Post reports today that the armada, the flotilla, the carrier group behind the Carl Vinson, actually never headed toward the Korean Peninsula. In fact, it did not sail north from Singapore on April 8th. Instead, it took a course that has led it 3,000 miles from the Korean Peninsula. It is now lurking in the Indian Ocean. And we have no explanation as to why we were told it was headed toward North Korea or why it didn't go there. Meanwhile, you know, dictators got to stick together, or would-be authoritarians. So yesterday, Trump called the president of Turkey, who just rammed through in a challenged election a series of referenda that sharply expand his autocratic rule and allow him to stay in office at least for another 10 years, if not longer. And Trump, of course, based on what we're told, didn't discuss the serious issues related to the conduct of the election and whether the results are credible. Now, he just congratulated Erdogan on cementing his power, probably the way the Donald lusts for here in the United States. And then they moved on to other topics. They talked about Syria and Assad and were pretending that Turkey remains a great ally in the effort to take down the Islamic State. But that referendum has serious issues. First of all, the official tally showed it passing by a slim margin, 51.4 to 48.6%. And an observer group said that 2.5 million votes, roughly twice the margin of victory, are highly suspicious. Now, there are many suspicions, and there are some videos that at least anecdotally support this, of widespread ballot box stuffing in almost all of the 165,000 ballot boxes nationwide. And they changed the rules right in the middle of the election process on Sunday, the day of the election. The Electoral Commission increased the burden needed to prove allegations of ballot box stuffing by removing a requirement for stamps on the ballot and on the envelope in which it is placed. Now, you might say, oh, these are mere technicalities. You know, the will of the people has been expressed. But we've seen this kind of gamesmanship with the election process, oh, right here in the United States. It will unlikely affect the outcome. My headline would read, In About Face, May Seeks June Election. This relates to the United Kingdom, where Theresa May serves as Prime Minister despite the fact that she was not elected to the job. She took over when David Cameron resigned in disgrace after the narrow passage of the Brexit referendum, the advisory referendum that passed last year, and that Theresa May has treated as a command to depart from the European Union. And she has begun the Brexit process by invoking, I think it's Article 50 of the European Union agreement, and that process is underway. Now, Theresa May had said that she would not call for an election, and she has the latitude to do that under British rules, before 2020. But she has declared that Westminster is the problem. Westminster is the section of London where Parliament meets. And so, in language that is more meaningful in Britain, she said the country is coming together, but Westminster is not. And she only recently and reluctantly came to this conclusion. Therefore, she's calling snap elections for June 8th, and this is breaking her oft-repeated vow. But she sizes it up that she doesn't have the votes in Parliament to complete the Brexit process, and that before they get into the messy details and the Conservative Party loses traction, that she wants to shore up her support. So she's hoping to add to her margin, which is only 17 votes, in the Parliament, and I believe that's the House of Commons. And so this is a risky move. I honestly don't know the answer to the question I'm about to ask, and that is, what if she doesn't gain seats in Parliament? What if she loses? Well, the other parties are in somewhat disarray. The Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn doesn't seem to have much going on right now. And there is a Liberal Party candidate who has gained some ground in recent weeks. But this is a bit of a head-scratcher, and we'll continue to watch it and see where it goes. Today I'm releasing a new in-depth interview to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com and everywhere else you can find the podcast, except for YouTube. The interviews don't get distributed to YouTube. And my guest this time is Wilmer J. Leon III. He's got a doctorate in political science, and he's an African-American commentator who's just published a new book based on his columns during the Obama administration called Politics, Another Perspective. Commentary and analysis on race, war, ethics, and the American political landscape in the age of Obama. And Wilmer Leon gave me a very direct answer when I asked him why Hillary Clinton lost last November. So, Wilmer, in your view, why did Hillary Clinton lose last year?
Because she ran a lousy, lousy, lousy...
Wait a minute. It was the Russians. It was Comey.
You don't have to go to Russia, call the Republicans, and you don't have to go to Comey or the Kremlin. Just call Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, and the cross-check program. and then we can talk about what really impacted the vote. And Greg also was able to point out and show the data that Donald Trump, if the votes in Detroit had all been counted, he would have lost Detroit by a huge margin. And surprisingly to some, not me, because I called it, he would have lost Arizona and Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Wilmer J. Leon III. We covered a lot of ground, and I found his comments interesting and worthy of your consideration. He and I agree on many issues, including the outsized role of Israel in defining American foreign policy and influencing leaders of both parties. My podcasts are made possible by people like you, who send in $5 or $10 a month, $50 a year. We call it a subscription. And every day I like to pause for a second and identify the people who do that, like Jeff Lipinski, Don Cisney, Julie Dupree, Casey Condon, and the folks at DGL Engraving. I really, really appreciate your support. And if you're not a subscriber, you can change that. You've got the power. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, pull it down, click on become a subscriber, it takes you to the sign-up page. The options are clearly laid out for there, and make a choice that's comfortable for you. I appreciate your support. And one of the things that I didn't get to talk to Wilmer Leon about, which broke today, is something that touches me, and it actually brought a couple of tears to my eye. And let me tell you that I was educated by the Jesuits at a school in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I respect the Jesuits as the Catholic order that has really provided great educational institutions. And one of them is Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And it was discovered last year that in 1838, the Jesuits who founded Georgetown sold 272 slaves and used the proceeds to help endow what was a floundering new college. So Georgetown is based on the slave trade. It is based on the fruits of that immoral, unconscionable system. And to its credit, the leaders of Georgetown convened a ceremony today, a religious service, where they apologized, held a day of repentance, and they hosted over 100 men and women whose ancestors were among those sold as slaves in 1838. And the participants spoke, sometimes eloquently. And here is a comment from a woman named Mary Williams Wagner. She made her first trip to Washington. She's from Rockport, Louisiana. She and her brother had read that they were the descendants of slaves sold in Meringuin, Louisiana, the tiny town where their mother grew up. Then they learned they were related to Isaac Hawkins, the first slave listed on the sale agreement, and today Georgetown named a building for Isaac Hawkins. And Miss Williams Wagner brought her granddaughter to the services, and her granddaughter's name is Neil. And she is interested in the offer from Georgetown to give basically the kind of special treatment that the kids of alumni get in special consideration for admissions to Georgetown. I'd love to see that girl, Neil, get a diploma from Georgetown in the next few years. Jeff Sessions, who I refer to as Jefferson Beauregard Jim Crow Sessions. He has tried to manipulate recent crime statistics to scare people into believing that we have a crime wave that requires a new war on crime led by Jeffrey Beauregard Jim Crow Sessions. And while it is narrowly true that murder rates in some urban areas, notably Chicago, Baltimore, St. Louis, and Milwaukee, have gone up, that overall, crime rates across the country are down and down at historic lows. And yet Jeff Sessions wants to tell you that the violent crime rate increased between 14 and 15 by 3%, and that this means that we've got to lock people up for longer periods of time and really revisit what Obama tried to correct. And this was a central part of my conversation. with Wilmer Leon today, that Obama did start the process of commuting sentences, but he didn't reschedule marijuana and he didn't really complete the job. And now, because many Trump voters are scared shitless because all they do is watch TV, and between Fox News and primetime dramas and movies that they see, they believe that crime is everywhere and that they should hunker down, get their guns and their bulletproof vests out. Because 78% of Trump's supporters told a Pew survey last November that crime has gotten worse in the United States since that black guy got into the White House. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, was at a public event today at about the same time that Steve Stevens, who was being cornered by the cops near Erie, Pennsylvania, took out a gun and killed himself. Now, Steve Stevens is becoming a household name because he posted a video of a murder that he committed in Cleveland over the weekend. He shot and killed a 74-year-old man named Robert Godwin Sr. Now, Steve Stevens himself, in the video, which of course was highly implicating or incriminating of him, he turns to the camera and says, "I just snapped, man. Fuck." And then he posted the video live on Facebook. About 1,000 people saw it before Facebook was able to lock down his account and prevent any further plays of the video. And as you know, I use Facebook Live video. I think it's very cool. It's a great way to reach a lot of people. And people are drawn to video presentations of many varieties. But this is an issue that Facebook will have to deal with, and I, for one, do not have an easy solution. The number of searches of cell phones and computers at border crossings, primarily airports, is skyrocketing. A report released last week shows a 79% increase in the number of electronic devices searched by Customs and Border Patrol at U.S. border entry points. And between October 15 and March 16, they had searched about 8,300 devices. A year later, that number has almost doubled to just under 15,000. And we still don't have good guidance. It is believed that the authority does exist for them to demand almost anything of anyone, even an American citizen without a criminal record or any other complications, that we must submit to these kinds of searches. And look what they do to rationalize this, all right? Here's a statement from the Deputy Executive Assistant Commissioner, John Wagner. He said that these searches affect fewer than 0.01% of international travelers. They have contributed to national security investigations, arrests for child pornography, and evidence of human trafficking. Now, I deplore violations of national security, makers and users of child pornography, and human trafficking. But the idea that people at the border are there to look for kiddie porn violations is really insulting. This is mission creep, pure and simple. Because we were told that all the stuff at the airports, all the stuff at the borders, is to protect us from terrorism, to protect us from foreign invasion. And I have a friend, or a guy I know. He's in his late 70s now, and he ended up doing a couple of years in federal prison because he came back to the United States and was stopped at San Francisco International Airport. They took his computer. They found a couple of images of child pornography that he thought had been erased from that computer. They had no warrant. They had no probable cause. They simply took advantage of his willingness to let them look at his computer. And that's not what is supposed to be going on. But most people can rationalize that. Well, say, you know, child pornography, that's evil, and who cares what the process is to intercept the people who've got it? Well, I do. Similarly, immigration arrests have risen 33% in the first weeks of the new administration. And I freely acknowledge that Barack Obama was responsible for deporting more people than his predecessors, 2.5 million people in 8 years. But the Trump immigration teams are hoping to beat that record in short order, and they're doing it by changing the terms of who gets deported. Now, most of the 2.5 million that were deported under Obama were people who were suspected of, or in most cases, had been convicted of a serious crime. But those standards have been blown out. And now, basically anybody who comes into contact with ICE, who is deportable for any reason, will be expelled. Kudos to WhoWhatWhy.com and Russ Baker. They were the persistent critics of the official narrative of the investigation of the Boston Marathon bombing 4 years ago, April 15th. Their reporting is now being validated by a book that's been published by investigative journalist Michelle McPhee. And the book is called Maximum Harm, and it opens up a lot of the questions about the way the FBI managed the investigation, the manhunt that was conducted, the prior contacts between Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the brothers, and the FBI and the CIA. And there remain many unanswered questions that the corporate media doesn't have any interest in exploring. And I'm linking in the show file for today's podcast to Who What Why's interview by Jeff Schechtman of Michelle McPhee. I think you'll find it very interesting. I plan to get her book and read it, and when I have, I'll try to line up an interview and bring it to you, maybe in the next month or 6 weeks. And finally, I've been holding on to this piece that Glenn Greenwald published last week at The Intercept. He describes a recent speech by CIA Director Mike Pompeo, which is chilling if you have any concern for your First Amendment rights and the rights of journalists. Because what Greenwald pointed out, and let me note that this was published last week and I have seen nothing, no outrage or other response from mainline, mainstream media editorialists or commentators or any elected officials, because this was basically an assault on WikiLeaks. And Mike Pompeo is calling for a big crackdown. Greenwald, quote, Trump's CIA director stood in public and explicitly threatened to target free speech rights and press freedoms, and it was almost impossible to find even a single U.S. mainstream journalist expressing objections or alarm, because the targets Pompeo chose in this instance are ones they dislike. But in vilifying WikiLeaks, we've got to note that the Washington Post, the New York Times, and many other outlets have freely used the product of WikiLeaks while failing to come to the defense of the right of WikiLeaks to collect and publish information regarded as secret. More from Greenwald here. Decreeing with no evidence that WikiLeaks is a non-state, hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors like Russia, a belief that has become gospel in establishment Democratic circles, Pompeo proclaimed that we have to recognize that we can no longer allow Assange and his colleagues the latitude to use free speech values against us. He also argued that while WikiLeaks pretended that America's First Amendment freedom shield them from justice, they may have believed that, but, says Pompeo, they are wrong. Now, in a separate passage, Greenwald points out that America's security and secrecy laws do not apply to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. He's not an American citizen. He's not operating in the United States. And so this is a lot of sound and fury. But is there a legal basis to pursue it? And Greenwald points out that the Obama administration tried every which way they could, including a secret grand jury, to try to indict Julian Assange. And they could not come up with a legal basis to silence WikiLeaks. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment podcast. It's available free every day, including on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.